Before it could, Katie shoved it away. She still loved Roe, she always would. She would miss him while he was in the mountains. But why is he going to the mountains? Her mind demanded, hammering her with the question, refusing to relent. Why is he going to the mountains, Katie? Why is he going to the... Shut up, Katie whispered, and picked up her book. 3 weeks passed, then four, and still William Tyr did not return. Katie knew that Tyr was dead. She had no gift of vision. The answer was much simpler. She knew because Jonathan knew. He still kept himself very close, but by now Katie had learned to read him better than anyone, to pass his words, to extrapolate from the little he revealed. In the fifth week, when the knock came on Jonathan's door in the middle of the night, it was Katie who answered, because she knew. The woman outside the door was almost unrecognizable as Aunt Maddie. She was in the final stages of starvation, each bone visible in her pallid face, even by candlelight. When Katie grabbed her arm, Aunt Maddie's skin burned beneath her fingers. Katie's mind registered these things, but even then her first priority was to get Aunt Maddie inside, to get the door closed. She knew that Aunt Maddie was dying, because no one could survive the condition Katie saw before her. But even in that early moment, some part of Katie had already focused on the greater priority, keeping a secret. Aunt Maddie told them her story in a hoarse, rasping voice, her skeletal hands clasped in front of her. All of the muscle that had roped her body was gone now, and her forearms were little more than twigs. "He couldn't do it," she murmured, and though she didn't look at any of them, Katie knew that she was talking to Lily. "You remember the last time? It almost took everything out of him. Whether he was too old or whether it was harder in the other direction, I don't know. But I saw that he wasn't going to make it, that he would kill himself trying. I tried to help him. Grabbed his hand, thought he could draw on me for some of it, and he did. But it still didn't work. The door wouldn't open." Katie didn't understand much of this, but a quick look around showed that she was the only one in the dark. Jonathan and Lily wore identical expressions of resignation, their eyes downcast. "In the end, I saw that it was killing him. He knew it, too, because he shoved me away. But before he died, he gave me this." She reached into her pocket and came up with Tyr's sapphire dangling on its fine silver chain. The chain had become tangled, the silver dulled by tarnish, but the jewel gleamed as brightly as ever. "He told me to give it to you," Aunt Maddie croaked, offering it to Jonathan. "And now I have." Jonathan took the jewel on his palm and stared at it for a long time. Katie could usually tell what he was thinking, but in this moment she had no idea. At some point, Lily had gotten up and left the room, and now she came back with a plate, piled high with bread and cheese. But Maddie only stared at the food for a moment, then looked up at them, her eyes dark and flat. "I'm dying. I know I am. I made it back here because I had his share of the food. But whatever he pulled out of me, it's gone forever. Every day I weaken. What about his body? Lily asked. Gone, Aunt Maddie replied. I had to dump it overboard. At this, Lily turned away and didn't speak. Jonathan was still staring at the jewel in his hand. Katie longed to grieve for William Tyr, but she could not, for Tyr himself had already directed her thoughts toward the more important issue. How would this affect Jonathan? What would the town do when it found out that Tyr was dead? The others might not have travelled so far in their thinking, but a deep part of Katie's mind had already grasped the implications and begun to think of concealment. We can't tell anyone, Aunt Maddie announced, and Katie looked up gratefully. What are you talking about? Lily asked. We can't keep this a secret. Of course we can, Aunt Maddie replied, her rasping voice closing off all argument. This is the last thing the town needs right now. Katie nodded. William Tyr had always been the stopgap for the worst impulses of the town. Without him, there would be nothing to stand in the way of Paul Anscott, or any one of the countless other forces grappling for influence. Sooner or later, people would conclude that Tyr was dead. But even uncertainty was preferable to the facts. How can we keep something like that a secret? Lily demanded. What will people say when they see you've come back without him? They won't see anything. I don't have long. Aunt Maddie pushed herself up from the sofa. Even in the soft candlelight, Katie fancied that she could see the bones of Aunt Maddie's arms through her skin. I'm leaving. Now, before the sun comes up. You can't! Aunt Lily cried, her voice cracking. Lil. Aunt Maddie grabbed her shoulder, squeezing it until Lily winced. Stop. But where will you go? It doesn't matter, Aunt Maddie replied. This is more important than either of us. It always was. And you knew it as well as I did. He told me you were always one of us. Even way back then, in Boston. She turned and limped down the hallway. She's right, Mom, Jonathan said quietly, turning the sapphire over in his hands. Dad dead, and this town falls apart.
We have to stop her!
Lily insisted, but neither Katie nor Jonathan moved, and when Lily made to get up, Katie grabbed her arm and pulled her back down. A few seconds later, the front door clicked shut, and Lily began to sob. Katie wanted to cry as well. For William Tyr, for Aunt Maddie, and even more for what they had all lost. The entire town. But in the face of Jonathan's stoicism, she had no choice but to swallow her own tears, turning her thoughts to the immediate future. No one was ready to hear that William Tyr was dead. Tyr had left Mum in charge, but that was an interim solution. Mum was not the woman to hold the town together for the long term. It would have to be Jonathan. But the town wasn't ready to accept that, either. Aunt Maddie was right. Tyr's death would have to be concealed at all costs. Katie was a guard now, and secrets were her business. but a rogue part of her mind could not help wishing that this charge had fallen to someone else. She loved the town, and she was no good at telling lies. "You'll learn," Tyr whispered inside her head, and Katie shivered, realizing the truth of that voice. She was working for a dead man now. Chapter 9. Flight. Even at this late date, we have been unable to discover any conclusive proof of the origins of the Red Queen. This historian believes that she was born in one of the small villages of northern Mortmain, but this is guesswork only. For how can we research a woman about whom so little is known, not even her true name? The Tierling as a military nation, Callow the Martyr. When the Queen woke, she lay still for a moment. She was sure she'd heard something, a rustling on the far wall. Once, during a particularly cold winter, the palais had become infested with rats. They'd taken care of it with poison bait, but perhaps the rodents had come back. "They have indeed." The Queen's mouth stretched in a cold smile. More of her people deserted every day. Her throne room had not been cleaned for a week, since most of the palais cleaning staff had run off. Half of her own personal guard could not be found. Ghislaine, her guard captain, was the only reason the Queen dared to sleep. At this moment, Ghislaine stood watch outside her chamber door. Beyond her windows, she could hear the distant sounds of battle in the city. Demain was in anarchy. That odd rustling sound came again. The Queen uttered a low curse and reached for her candle. She slept very little at night anyway. It was so much easier to fall asleep in the daytime, in the light. The room beyond her covers was ice cold, full of draughts from the many broken windows in the palais. 3 weeks ago, the King of Kader had missed his first shipment in more than 20 years. Even the thought of it made the Queen's blood boil. The old bastard had sensed her weakness, and the Queen, who had not had to worry about Kader for years, suddenly had a problem on her southern border. Glass, once cheaper than food on the streets of Demain, was about to become a priceless commodity, and the Queen, who had once had the best insulated bedroom in the kingdom, now shivered beneath her blankets. The treasury couldn't spare the money to repair windows. The palais was wide open to the early winter air, as well as whatever vermin might crawl inside. The Queen found her matches, sat up, and lit the candle. Her chamber looked as always, crimson walls and furniture. They'd had to replace almost all of the furnishings after the Dark Thing's fire this past summer, but her furnishers had done an admirable job, making the new room almost identical to the old. Where were those furnishers now? Fled, most likely, to join Le Vieux and his band of traitors. A civil war raged in Demain, and on some days the Queen could convince herself that she was winning, but most days she knew she was not. "This is what the fall feels like," the Queen thought, wrapping herself in a robe. As a child, she had read her history. Her nurse, Wright, had forced her to read many pages on the fall of dictators throughout the world, but no one ever mentioned how soporific the experience was. Almost narcotic, like being lulled to sleep. She was fighting an invisible enemy, one who did not announce his victories but stole away into the night. Gradually, more and more of her city was being annexed by Le Vieux and his rebels, and she only found out about specific incursions after the deed was done. paralysis was setting in, for it was easy, so damned easy, to simply sit here, barricaded in, clutching her crown, her throne, until someone came and took them away. On her bedside table, twinkling darkly in the candlelight, lay the 2-tier sapphires, and the queen stared at them for a long moment, hearing the girl's voice inside her head. You lost. Yes, she had lost. Whatever the girl had done, she had done it well. The sapphires were a broken tool, just like Ducat. When the Red Queen went to bed, Ducat had been down the hall, closeted with several of the Queen's generals. To the outward eye, it looked like a strategy meeting. But the Queen knew what it really was. Hiding. All of her generals were now hunted, for it was common knowledge that she had compensated them out of the treasury. If the regular army got hold of any of the High Command, their fates would be no prettier than her own. More rustling from the far wall. With a sigh, the Queen tucked the sapphires into her pocket, then tiptoed toward the far corner of the room. If a rat was here, she would kill it. There was nowhere for it to hide except beneath the bed or the sofa. As a child, she used to kill rats to pass the time when she was left alone. Evie. She placed her fingers against her temples, willing the voice away. But these days, it seemed that all the power in the world would not give her command of her own mind. Her mother's voice was always there, hectoring, criticizing, finding fault. The girl had woken the beautiful queen, and she would not go back to sleep. The floor was freezing against the queen's feet, and she cast around for her slippers, finding them beneath her desk. She was halfway across the room when the rustling came again, directly over her head. Evie. The queen looked up and felt her blood turn to ice. There was a little girl on the ceiling. Her thin limbs were white and bloodless. Her grimy fingers appeared to be latched to the wood, allowing her to cling there like an insect. Her back faced the queen, dark hair hanging beneath her. She was dressed in rags. The queen forced herself to take a deep breath, deep enough to make her muscles unlock. She backed toward the wall, and the little girl followed, scuttling across the ceiling like a spider. The rustling sound was the child's knees scraping against the wood. It reached the join of wall and ceiling and began to crawl down the wall. Again the queen thought of a spider. Not the webbed spiders of southern Mortmain, but the hunting spiders of the Fairwitch foothills, which would stalk their prey for long minutes across grass and rocks. They were slow in the early going, but could move like lightning as they closed in. Keeping her eyes on the girl, the queen backed toward her desk. She had a knife in the top drawer, though she was unsure whether a knife would be of any value here. This creature belonged to the dark thing. She could sense the similarity in the strange, shifting texture of the girl's form. Not wholly solid, this child. Almost as though she were not real, and the queen, who had the ability to turn a man inside out in 100 different ways, could not find anywhere on the child's body to begin. If she could not reach it with her mind, then she was unlikely to reach it with a weapon. But a knife was better than nothing, and she fumbled in the drawer, pushing aside paper and pens and stamps, searching for the sharp edge of the blade. She tried to call up what she remembered from conversations with the dark thing. So long ago, when they had been allies. Or at least when it had still considered her useful. There wasn't much. The dark thing had taught her a great deal, but about its own history, the strange transformation that had made it what it was? It remained silent. The girl reached the bottom of the wall and clambered to her feet. The queen shuddered, for she recognized the rags the girl wore, remnants of one of the cheap blue uniforms that had once been used to clothe auctioned slaves. But Mortmain hadn't used such uniforms for more than 40 years, long before Broussard's tenure as auctioneer. This child would have been in one of the earliest loads sent north to the Fair Witch, back when a much younger Queen of Mortmain still thought she could placate the dark thing, buy him off with homeless children culled from the city streets. The girl's eyes were dark and empty, and when she spoke, her voice was hoarse, as though she hadn't used it in a long time.
"I don't want to go," she rasped. "Don't make me get on the wagon."
The queen scooted away, around the back end of the sofa. She tested the girl again, gently pushing with her mind, and found that she had been right. The girl's flesh was like the dark thing's, low and humming like a hive, not entirely there. The queen looked down at her candle, wondering if the girl would burn. But no, nothing that belonged to the dark thing would ever be vulnerable to flame.
"I want my maman,"
said the girl, her voice plaintive.
"Where are we going?"
"You're no ghost," the queen countered. "You're a pawn. He told you to say this to me."
The girl vaulted over the edge of the sofa, reminding the queen again of a hunting spider. The child's size was deceptive. It had tricked the queen into expecting a child's speed and reflexes. The queen backed across the room, nearly stumbling on the hem of her nightgown, and the girl darted forward, her blank face becoming eager and hungry. The queen suddenly remembered a long night out in the Fair Witch, the snow steeping into drifts and the wind howling across the frozen wastes of the mountainside. The dark thing had wrapped her with fire, keeping her warm, and the queen had been astonished to find that even though she was inside the blaze, she felt no pain. She had reached up to touch the flames, and the dark thing had grabbed her hand.
"Don't be fooled by the reprieve," he told her. "In the end, we all burn."
"Burn?" the queen whispered, almost wondering. Her entire acquaintance with the orphan had been a history of fire held in abeyance, but now the flames were upon her. She turned and fled for the door, heard the slap of the girl's running feet right behind her. She got the door open and slipped through, but then her trailing hand was seized as though in a vice, and she screamed as she felt the girl's teeth sink into the flesh of her wrist. She caught a wild glimpse of the sofa beside her doorway, and there was Ghislaine, dead, his skin bleach white. The cushions beneath him were soaked with blood.
"We all burn."
"Not yet,"
the queen snarled. She jerked her arm forward, ramming the girl's head against the far side of the door, and felt the teeth dislodge from her wrist. Then she was fleeing down the corridor toward her audience chamber, the rabbit patter of the girl's feet right behind her. The hallway in front of her was empty and endless. "What can I do?" the queen wondered. She recognized the voice of incipient panic, but could not seem to control it.
"Where is everyone?"
Through an open doorway on her left, she saw several of her generals piled against the far wall, their limbs haphazard, as though they'd been thrown there. Blood had puddled and trailed on the chamber floor.
"I heard nothing,"
the queen thought, almost marveling, before the girl caught the trailing end of her robe, and the queen was suddenly jerked backward, landing painfully and thumping her head on the floor. The girl jumped on top of her, giggling, the laugh of a child playing at a particularly good game. The queen grabbed the child's throat, holding her off, but the girl was stronger than a man, and she wriggled free of the queen's grasp. The queen summoned what strength she had and shoved the girl away across the corridor to slam into the wall. But a moment later, the girl was back up again, her grimy face full of white teeth. She didn't even appear dazed. Can't win, the queen realized. Already she felt herself weakening. Her wrist was pouring blood. She pressed it against the waist of her robe, trying to staunch the flow, and felt something hard and unyielding in her pocket. The tear sapphires.
You are fun to hunt,
the girl lisped, her eyes no longer dull and lifeless, but bright, sparkling with a glee so dark it was almost madness.
More fun than the others.
The queen turned and fled down the corridor. Behind her came the girl, giggling. The queen reached a connecting door and slammed it behind her, then turned and ran, the breath tearing from her throat. Behind her, she heard a cracking sound as wood shattered, but she was nearly to the door of her throne room now, and that door was made of good Mort steel, with an answering steel deadlock. It would not hold forever, but it would give her some breathing room, time to figure out what to do. She stumbled through the door, limping, gasping, and slammed it shut behind her, shooting the bolt. Behind her came the sound of stifled gasping. The queen turned and found a naked man and woman on her throne, intertwined, oblivious to her entrance.
On my throne,
the queen murmured, her voice a series of ghastly echoes that faded into the far corners of the room. The woman looked up, and the queen saw that it was Juliet, her brow shining with sweat.
Majesty?
She stammered.
On my throne, the queen howled,
her wounds and weakness forgotten, even the child forgotten. She shoved out with her mind, flinging Juliet across the room and into the far wall. Juliet's spine shattered, and she fell to the floor, her corpse still twitching. The queen turned to the man, curled up now on the throne, clutching his legs, trying to shield his rapidly wilting erection. The spectacle was so sad that the queen began to laugh. She thought he was one of the palais guards, but could not be sure, and either way he seemed so insignificant that the queen could not even recover her anger. Normally, the throne room would have a full complement of guards, even in the middle of the night. But not now. The queen ignored the man as he crept off the throne and crouched behind it, his terrified eyes peeping over the arm. She turned to Juliet's broken body and felt a brief moment of regret. Even Julie would have been better help than no one at all. A thundering blow slammed against the steel door of the throne room. The queen looked around wildly, seeking any weapon, only to realize the futility of that. No sword would take the girl down. Even her own magic was not enough. She reached into her pocket and pulled out the tear sapphires. Perhaps now, in her peril, they would respond. But nothing. Their power was as far beyond her reach as ever. Only one person knew how to use them. Another blow at the door. This time, the impact sent a long blister down the steel surface. The queen turned and fled, through the great double doors into the wide hallway that led to the main gate. She could not go out the gate. A massive mob had been gathered around the palais for days, a mob that would probably tear her to pieces if given an opportunity. But there were other routes out of the castle. The queen, who believed in prudence, had prepared well for this day, though she had believed it would never come. Running, her mind whispered as she ran, her bare feet slapping against the flat stones of the hallway, running away. The idea made the queen snarl, but she could not deny it. She was running, fleeing the seat of her power, the palais she had built brick by brick. The construction had taken more than 15 years, and she had given the architect, a man named Clunder, a lifetime pension for his work. The palais was the seat of her government, but it was much more than that. It was the place that had allowed her to forget her youth, to wash away her childhood in the Tearling, to build her own history from scratch. She could not believe how quickly the fall had come. Ahead of her, around the next corner, a man screamed, and she heard the sounds of a struggle, muffled by the thick stone walls. Her feet slowed automatically, and she turned to look behind her. There was only a long, empty hallway, dappled with patches of darkness where the torches had been allowed to burn out. But now, distant and yet not too distant, she heard a high, happy giggle. Damned either way. The queen took off running again, breath tearing from her throat, but as she careened around the corner, her feet came together in a flat halt. Some 20 feet in front of her was Ducat, veering madly from side to side, bashing himself against the walls. 2 children, a boy and a girl, were attached to his body. They twined around him like serpents, hands and arms seemingly everywhere, and Ducat screamed as the girl bit into the back of his neck. The queen remained frozen for a long time, trying to sort out what she was seeing. Did they drink blood, these children? Or were they trying to feed? But then the giggle came again, and the queen whirled around. There was nothing behind her, but the sound had been very close. Ducat stumbled to his knees, and the boy made a low growling noise, the satisfied grunt of an animal that had brought down prey. The queen could not outrun these children forever. They were too strong, and while the scattered reports from northern Mortmain had become increasingly bizarre over the past month, they were very clear on one thing. There were a lot of these things, too many to repel. The queen needed help, but her only ally was dying before her eyes. You lost. The queen's eyes opened wide. She had thought she was out of options, but no. One remained. She felt suddenly galvanized, new life in her legs. Leaving Ducat to his fate, she turned right and darted down a nearby staircase, heading for the dungeons. The man in the next cell knew more science than anyone Kelsey had ever met, including Carlin. His name was Simon, and he had been a slave since his 16th year. Upon his arrival in Mortmain, he had been sold from master to master for heavy labour, until his 5th master finally realised that Simon had a great aptitude for building and fixing. The next sale had been to a scientist, a man who designed weapons for the Mort army. The scientist, whom Simon spoke of with real affection, had also loaned Simon out to several like-minded men, all of whom had taught him something. Elementary physics, a bit of chemistry, even the properties of plants, a subject on which Simon seemed to know as much as Barty. He had quickly surpassed his new master and begun to design more complex, offensive weapons. It had not taken long for him to come to the Red Queen's attention. "The footbridges?" Kelsey asked. "The platforms the Mort used to cross the river. Were those your handiwork?"
"A group effort," Simon replied. "The design was mine, but I needed the help of a physicist to understand weight ratios and leverage. My gifts are mechanical, not theoretical."
"Yet you made a printing press," Kelsey mused, still marvelling at the idea.
"It's a simple press, hand-operated.
but it will output 20 pages a minute if run properly. The hourly rate goes down as you need to include loading time for the plates, and each page needs at least several minutes to dry properly. Some day a better man than I will invent ink that doesn't smear.
20 pages a minute, Kelsey repeated faintly. The man on the far side of the wall seemed suddenly more valuable than all the gems in Kader. It was the middle of the night, but Kelsey had been awake for more than 2 hours. Emily, the page, sat outside her cell, apparently standing guard. It was almost like having Mace himself there, except that Emily had fallen asleep, her knife clutched in her hand. Kelsey's mind continued to run busily on the same track it had run so many times before. What were the sapphires really? Why could she use them when the Red Queen could not? The small chunk of sapphire from Katie's world was in Kelsey's lap, but it merely lay there, inert. She felt that she was very close to an answer of some kind, but every time she reached out to grasp it, it danced just beyond her reach. The dungeon was wearing on her ability to think critically. A few more months in here and even rudimentary thinking might feel like slogging through mud. She lashed a vicious kick at the bars, hating them, hating the Red Queen, the palais around her, this cursed country, all of them conspiring to keep her from her home.
You'll break your foot doing that,
Simon remarked mildly, and Kelsey drew her feet beneath her with a low oath. She sensed a storm brewing, but whether that storm gathered in the present, the future, or the past, she could not say. William Tyr's town was beginning to crumble. Kelsey looked down at the rock in her lap, considering it. So much sapphire underlying the Tyrling. Was it all the same? And did it even matter? Tyr had understood his sapphire, controlled its power so much better than Kelsey did, but he still hadn't been able to save his town. Or his son. A few more years, and the dark-eyed boy, who only wanted what was best for everyone, would be dead. How did Jonathan Tyr die? Kelsey didn't know why, but sometimes she felt that everything hinged on this question. Roe Finn was the obvious suspect. Even if Katie couldn't put two and two together, Kelsey could. Corpses stolen, silver stolen, Roe's bright fascination with Tyr's jewel. Katie would have bet her kingdom that the second Tyr necklace had come from Roe's talented metalworking hands. But that wasn't all. In the dark of the town, Roe was up to no good. Katie didn't want to think about these things, but Kelsey could and did. Who killed Jonathan Tyr? Kelsey frowned at the piece of loose sapphire in her lap. She wished she could speed up Katie's memory, skip over that mental film, but sapphires or no, that had never been within her power. She could only watch and wait. She wondered if she had the power to make Katie kill Roe Finn before it was too late, for they were not always divided, Katie and Kelsey. Sometimes they blended, in that wholly organic way that Kelsey remembered from those last desperate moments with Lily. But something in her balked at that solution. It seemed too easy. Roe was riding a wave in the town, a wave of discontent and fear. But was he really the cause? Kelsey didn't think so. A part of her wanted to kill Roe anyway, just on principle. But she recognized that part very well. The Queen of Spades, forever circling in her mind, always looking for a way back in. Past, present, or future, it made no difference. That side of Kelsey would be perfectly happy to run through the new world, grinning blackly, meeting out justice with a scythe. No, Kelsey whispered.
You've gone very quiet over there, Simon remarked. Did I put you to sleep?
No, Kelsey replied slowly in a louder voice. Simon, let me ask you. If you had the chance to go back into history and correct a great evil, would you do so?
Ah, the old question.
Is it?
Yes, with a clear answer. Physicists look at it in terms of the butterfly effect.
What is that? Kelsey didn't know why she was pursuing this. Killing Roe was no answer for the town's troubles. According to history, the Tyr assassination was the problem. But there was no guarantee that killing Roe would prevent that. She wished she could see everything, know everything, all at once.
I've only read one book on the subject, Simon told her. The butterfly effect deals in the tendency of infinitesimal variations to amplify over time. You never play around with history, because the change you thought you were making for the better is likely to cause so many unforeseen ripples that it may well add up to a net loss. Too many variables to control the outcome.
Kelsey considered this for a moment. Simon had presented a scientific argument, but beneath it was a moral question. Whether she had the right to gamble with the future. In the brief 6 months she had sat on her throne, she had made many decisions, some good and some disastrous. Two Kelseys warred inside her. The child raised by Barty and Carlin to believe in easy rights and wrongs. And the Queen of Spades, who had come to see everything in shades of dark grey. The Queen of Spades didn't care about moral questions.
You didn't answer me, Simon. What would you do? You mean, would I dice with the chance that something even worse would come along?
Yes. Is it a good gamble or a poor one?
I think the outcome would be entirely a matter of chance, of circumstance. Neither a good gamble nor a poor one, but a great gamble. One in which you would stake all, seeking a vast reward that might not materialize even if you did succeed. I'm a cautious man, not a gambler. I don't think I would chance it.
Kelsey sat back on her heels, nodding. She saw the argument. Even if she somehow succeeded in killing Roe Finn, another Roe might simply spring up in his place. Power was a double-edged sword. It didn't make Kelsey any more likely to do the right thing, and oh, the disastrous results when it led her wrong. She closed her eyes, and there was Arlen Thorne again, his face scrubbed with blood.
Strange turn of the conversation, said Simon. Can I ask?
A hollow boom echoed through the dungeon. Emily woke, instantly jumping to her feet. Kelsey sensed that she, like Mace, was embarrassed to be caught napping. She raised her knife to face the end of the corridor.
It is them,
Kelsey asked. If, as Emily said, Mace was planning a rescue attempt, it would explain what Emily was doing down here in the middle of the night.
No,
Emily shook her head.
More than a day early.
A fusillade of clanging blows rang through the corridor. It sounded like a child banging pots together, but in the echo-prone environment of the dungeons, the noise was almost deafening, and Kelsey had to clap her hands to her ears until it stopped.
"Is it a mob?" asked Simon from his cell.
Kelsey raised her eyebrows at Emily, who shook her head. According to the page, the palais was now surrounded by a mob, one selected and directed by Le Vieux. Mace and the fetch, working together. Kelsey would have to see it to believe it. As the echoes faded, a woman appeared on the staircase and came sprinting down the corridor. Mad, was Kelsey's first thought. The woman appeared to be wearing only a robe, and her hair was in disarray. She held a torch just above her head, and it seemed only blind luck that she had not set her own hair on fire. Her breath gasped from her throat, and her eyes were wide and desperate. The hem of her robe was stained with blood. "Declare yourself!" Emily cried. But a moment later, Emily was flung aside like a rag doll straight into the wall, where she collapsed to the floor. As the woman skidded to a stop in front of her cell, Kelsey's mouth dropped open. No one would have recognized this deranged creature as the Queen of Mortmain.
"No time," the Red Queen panted, "right behind me."
She dropped to Emily's inert body and began digging through her pockets.
"Key, key, key, where is it?"
The squeal of wrenching steel echoed down the hall from the stairwell, and a low animal moan emerged from the Red Queen's throat. She took her hands from Emily's pockets, defeated, and sat back on her heels for a moment before moving on to the chain around the woman's neck. "What is that?" Kelsey asked. The Red Queen pushed herself to her feet, holding the silver key in her left hand.
"It looks like a child," she murmured,
unlocking Kelsey's cell and throwing the door wide open.
"But it's not."
She held out her right hand, and there were Kelsey's sapphires on her palm. Kelsey gaped at this offering. The Red Queen's face was calm, but her eyes were wide with panic.
"Help me," she whispered. "Help me, please."
A giggle echoed down the corridor, and the Red Queen jumped. Leaning out of her cell, Kelsey saw a small form, too small to be anything but a child, at the foot of the stairwell. But this child's chin was smeared with red, and it wore a bib of blood.
"You are good at hide-and-seek,"
the child lisped, her thin voice echoing down the hall.
"But I have found you now."
"What is it?" Kelsey whispered.
"One of his. Please."
The Red Queen grabbed Kelsey's hand and pressed the sapphires into her palm, and Kelsey realized, astonished, that she was speaking not in Mort, but in Tyr.
"Please, they are yours. I give them back."
Kelsey stared at the sapphires in her hand. She had spent many months longing for her jewels, longing for the ability to punish and retaliate. But now that she had them in hand, she felt exactly the same. All of the power she had drawn from the sapphires, all of that ability to channel her anger into force, it was gone. But there was something there, for now she realized that she could actually tell them apart. The two jewels might appear identical, but they were different, utterly different. Two discreet voices inside her head. She had no time to analyze the difference. The child, a little girl, Kelsey saw now, was coming down the corridor, loping on all fours like a wolf, her teeth bared and face twisted in a snarl. The Red Queen ducked behind Kelsey, clutching her shoulder in an iron grip of terror. Kelsey wondered what she was supposed to do in the 2 seconds before the child reached them, how on earth she was supposed to have time to make a plan, let alone act. And time slowed down. Kelsey saw this quite clearly. The child, which had been coming along the corridor at great speed, was suddenly reduced to the lazy velocity of the mud turtles of the Reddick. She moved only by inches. No hurry at all, Kelsey thought, marveling. I have all the time in the world. She looked down at her sapphires, different, yes, but connected, wed to each other somehow. One of them was William Tears' sapphire. It spoke to her clearly, not in words, but in a flow of images, of ideas, speaking of the good and the light. Tears' sapphire, which had allowed him to master time, to bring them all safely across the Atlantic and God's ocean. Carlin had always said that Tears' settlers were lucky to stumble on the new world, the equivalent of hitting a bullseye on a dartboard in the pitch black. But that wasn't true at all. William Tear had known exactly where he was going. There was no luck involved, because it came from here, Kelsey whispered, feeling the very rightness of the idea. A piece of Tear sapphire had somehow found its way into the old world, and Kelsey saw its journey clearly, like a story inside her head, passed down from tear to tear, hidden and smuggled, sometimes to the far corners of the earth, concealed from the powerful, guarded from the weak. Centuries of tears, all of them fighting to hold back the darkness, to keep it at bay. Tears' sapphire dealt in time. It had allowed her to slow the ravening child before her, to lengthen the hallway until it was nearly infinite, to see into the past. How could I have ever thought they were identical? The difference was like a chasm in her mind. The other jewel's voice was low and hectoring, speaking of petty slights and jealousies, and desires, of sneaking and spying, anger and violence. This sapphire had also been passed down through generations of Raleighs, but it had never really belonged to any of them. Not even to Kelsey. Roe Finn? She thought so. Once he saw what Tears' sapphire could do, he would surely have tried to make his own. But he had not succeeded, not entirely, because this jewel was not independent. Kelsey could feel the bond between the two. Tears' sapphire governed in some way that she couldn't fully understand. Kept separate, Rose jewel could do very little. But together? Carlin, Kelsey whispered. Somehow Carlin had known, because Rose sapphire had lain around Kelsey's neck all through her childhood. She could almost see all the days of her youth reflected in its glassy surface, while Carlin had kept Tears' sapphire hidden away. And the Fetch had known too, for he had deliberately withheld Tears' sapphire while Kelsey was being tested. Rose sapphire was capable of small things. In several quick blinks of memory, Kelsey saw the Caden assassin lying on the floor of her bathroom. The Mort camp spread out below her eyes, the woman in the Almont screaming as her children were taken away. She had been able to see things far away to defend her own life. These were useful bits of magic. But once the two were a pair again...
Oh!
Kelsey gasped, horrified. An entire phalanx of images marched in front of her eyes now. Hundreds of soldiers in the Mort army, gone in a spray of blood and bone. The vast web of cuts and slices that had covered her. General Ducat's face twisted in agony. A set of open, bleeding cuts on the backs of Mace's hands, and worst of all, Arlen Thorne, who had suffered an even worse life than that of the Red Queen, but somehow deserved no mercy. Because... But Kelsey could not even remember what reason she had cobbled together for mutilating Thorne. She remembered doing the deed. Remembered black wings opening inside her. A darkness so inviting that a newly crowned Kelsey Glynn one who seemed years younger in hindsight, had longed to lose herself inside it. But only madness waited there. The same madness that Finn and his ilk had always wanted to inflict on the Tearling. Greed and callousness. Lack of empathy, a narrowing of mind until only one lonely voice was left, surrounded by a void into which it could howl only a single word, "Me!" With a cry of disgust, Kelsey yanked Finn Sapphire away from Tears and held it up before her eyes, thinking, "I want none of this. I want no part of it. I want my own self back." Something enormous wrenched inside her, as though muscle were peeling away from bone, and she suddenly understood. The Red Queen couldn't use the sapphires, not because they belonged to Kelsey, but because there was nothing left to use. Kelsey had drained them dry. The two sides, Tyr and Finn, had been warring inside her for months. For a moment, Kelsey felt as though her own flesh were pulling apart, as though she would literally split down the middle with the force of that wish to have Ro gone, to be Kelsey Glynn again. And then it was done. The great divide inside Kelsey seemed to seal itself closed. She was still angry, yes. But it was her anger. The engine that had always powered her, not to punish, but to fix, to right wrongs. And the relief of that was so great that Kelsey threw back her head and howled. The scream echoed up the corridor, but to Kelsey it seemed much more powerful than sound, as though it must shake the palais to its stone foundations. For a moment, she expected the entire building to come crashing down around them. When she opened her eyes, she found that the child had covered more than half of the distance. Rose Sapphire still dangled in front of Kelsey, not dark now, but bright and sparkling, its many facets gleaming, as though asking whether she would like to put it on again, just to try, just to see. She wrapped her fist around the jewel, blocking out that light, and shoved it back into the Red Queen's hand. An old memory occurred to her, speaking to the fetch beside a campfire back when she knew nothing and understood nothing, not even the real import of her own words. "Keep it, Lady Crimson. I'd rather die clean." She didn't know whether the Red Queen heard her. The woman remained frozen beside her, her eyes wide, almost mad. Only the faintest twitch of her fingers indicated that she registered the necklace, was beginning to close her hand into a fist. Casting around, Kelsey found that the page, Emily, was still lying unconscious at their feet, a large blue bruise in bloom at her temple. She could be no help. But beside her limp, curled fingers lay a long dagger, beautifully made. Kelsey grabbed it and found that it was more length than she was used to. Barty's knife, confiscated from Kelsey long ago in the Almont, had been at least 2 inches shorter. But this was at least a weapon that she could wield. "It's strong," the Red Queen told her, her words slow and distant. "Stronger than a man." "Then you'll have to help me," Kelsey replied. The Red Queen merely stared at her. "Help me! Do you understand?"
"With this?"
The Red Queen lifted Finn's sapphire. "No, put that away." The Red Queen tucked the sapphire away, and Kelsey felt relieved when it was out of her sight.
"I have magic, but it's no match for this creature,"
the Red Queen admitted.
"So what, then?"
"Good old brute strength. You help me hold her down, and I shove this dagger in her heart," The Red Queen shook her head.
These are not the monsters of the pre-crossing fiction.